This is David Bean from Nashville, Tennessee, and you are listening to Light Source.
And welcome to episode 42 of Light Source, the official podcast of StudioLighting.net, the website that introduces photographers to portrait and studio lighting equipment and techniques. I'm Bill Crawford, publisher.
And I'm Ed Hidden, exclusive photographer and image inspector with iStockPhoto.com. Now, on today's episode, we have with us David Bean. He is a photographer out of Nashville. He is a portrait photographer, does a lot of work with musicians, celebrities. It's a very edgy style. He has done a lot of work for companies like Paramount, ESPN, Fender, EMI, CMT, and a whole bunch of others.
And on top of all that, he's also very interested in helping photographers learn. So it was a really good chance to chat with him.
From looking at his portfolio again here while we're doing this intro tonight, he has some really interesting style with some of his double exposures and the post-processing that he does, so that'll be a treat for you guys to listen to. But before we get into that, we have gotten some emails recently.
Yes, we do.
We got one this week from, and I know I'm going to butcher the name and I apologize, it's Claudio Sergio Come. Let me try that again. Claudio. Wow. Claudio Sergio Como. I think that's probably about as close as I'm going to get. Well, this person writes, "Hello, guys, and greetings from Venezuela." There we go. That's why I couldn't get it right.
Exactly.
He's an amateur photographer who was on his way to become a pro and leave his day job. I hope his day job doesn't listen to this show and doesn't know about this. But anyway, that's my editorializing on this. Although he has done some professional work for clients in New York City as well as here in Venezuela. Anyway, enough of my stuff. I own a Nikon system with a D200 and 3 speed lights, and despite that I've gotten excellent results with those little wonders, I would love to jump into a more powerful light source. So here's the question. Do I really need a light meter?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, and he goes on to mention, I've heard from your guests on the show that some of them don't use light meters, and I would like to add that I think a lot of them don't seem like they use light meters.
Yeah, it's been surprising me too.
Yeah, and well, he goes on to say it, so he's confused. Do I want to buy one and try it if it's worth it or not? And then he goes on and talks about a couple other models to it. And I think my interpretation on this is if you're starting out with moving away from using speed lights and getting into something that's a little bit more manual, like a strobe system, I would recommend a light meter. And I think a lot of the guys that we listen to on the show that talk about not using a light meter started using one. And
just don't need it anymore.
Right. They're so used to, okay, this light is 5 feet from a subject and the subject is mostly, of a lighter tone. So it's going to be at half power or whatever they're used to using. So they've used their equipment so much day in and day out that they know where their settings are.
I'm with you on this, Ed. I think that there are times when you could get away with not using a light meter, but when you're first starting out with, especially with strobes, you can't really tell everything you need to know from the back of the camera. I mean, for example, one of the trickiest light situations for a beginner is when you're shooting like on a white screen or like a white background, and you're trying to not overexpose the background and still get good exposure on the subject. And you have, three or four lights that you're using, and you want to get kind of technical with that and make sure that you have one stop overexposed on the backdrop, and that you're not going to lose detail, So a light meter comes in really handy. And it's the kind of thing that there's been a couple of times, even though I don't use it on every shoot, I'm glad it's in my bag. Because I just, if you really got a tricky exposure situation, it's great to pull out and use.
And there are times where I have forgotten it and gotten away with using the histogram on the back of my camera. And then just kind of like through the shoot, I'm going, well, okay, I'm getting it. But it's just something that I really, really wished I would have had in some of those instances. So it's probably one of those, it's like, well, I wish I had it when I didn't. And when I have it, it's like, well, all right, I have it here.
Right. And now we are talking about flash meters. We should probably make that clear because we did say light meter a couple of times. And the difference is you can buy a light meter that is not a flash meter, and that really wouldn't get you anything that your camera can't already do. But the flash meter, the difference being that the flash meter can measure brief bursts of light from strobes and then tell you what the exposure would be from that. It kind of keeps that in memory when you press the trigger.
Right. And there are a whole host of features that are out there with all of the different meters. Claudio goes on to talk about two Siconic models, the L358, which is the one that I use, and the L758, which is one that someone that has a bigger pocket than I do uses.
Right. Well, you know, and there's a couple of other brands that aren't, there's other ones that are popular. The Minolta has a couple of popular meters, but there's also a couple that aren't as expensive that'll still do the job, I think, like the Polaris meter that I had for a while. You know, we're talking about a little over $100 for a new one. And so that's kind of a good investment, I think.
Yeah, and basically, in much the same way that a camera, the difference that you're going to get with the different meters is features. I mean, all of them are going to do the same basic task, and that's going to be measuring your flash. Some of them will measure ambient as well as flash. Some of them will measure your ratio from your ambient scene mixed in with your flash, and some of them go... Man, some of them even go really out of the ballpark. Like this, the L78 has camera profiles that you can download for calibration, which, I don't know, that starts to get a bit geeky for me, I think.
Right. I mean, if you're not doing like really technical work, or you're not a product photographer for magazines or something, I just think that you can get away with a lot less meter.
I completely agree with you. And that was also kind of the reason that I went with the one that I did, was because it does have some expandability to it, where I can add a viewfinder if I wanted to do any visual spotting with it. But I don't do a lot of landscape shooting or things that would really require me to do spot metering with any kind of a meter. So I never went with those accessories, but they also have the addition of adding Pocket Wizard to it.
I like that.
That is a really nice feature, but I don't have Pocket Wizard yet.
And now the way that would work is if you have Pocket Wizards to fire your strobes with your camera, you can put the module inside your meter as well. Then you don't have to, you know, you can use your meter to fire your strobes during testing wirelessly. And you don't have to plug a sync cord into it and drag it all over your set, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a nice feature to have. And Pocket Wizards are nice to have in your camera so you're not tripping over cables. But it just adds that extra feature of, oh, okay, I'll just walk in here. I'm not unplugging anything from the camera, plugging it into the right meter to take your reading. So those are good things. And I like the fact that I can upgrade mine.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point.
But I haven't spent that extra expense to actually do that yet because I don't have the features for it. But when that day comes, I know that I can.
Right. Now, one thing that, like, no matter what Ed and I say, if you say, you know what, I'm just going to use the back of my camera, I would say make sure on the shoot you have a laptop. And you do some test shots and you get an application that has a histogram for all three RGB like curves and really check to make sure that your reds aren't blowing out. Because on the back of the LCD, even if you have a histogram, which a lot of the DSLRs do, it's an average value that you're looking at if it's just a single line. Now, some of the higher end DSLRs have RGB curves in the histogram, but if you don't, you're really getting an average value and you're not seeing one channel that could be blowing out, which is common in portraits. For example, the red channel could blow out before the others do, and you're actually losing detail in the red channel and really not being able to tell even from the histogram. So if you're really bent on not having a meter and you're just starting out with strobes, then do yourself a favor and get a laptop, get something like Aperture or Lightroom, and just really take a hard look at some of your shots. Look at the detail in the forehead or some of the highlights of the, you know, white areas in your photo, and do a measurement on the screen just to have that peace of mind.
That's probably very wise advice. And if you already have the notebook, it's, you know, the only thing you really have to worry about is maybe shading the screen or something like that if you're going to be shooting outside. But you know, right, for the most part, that's good solid advice there.
Rocking.
Well, did we have anything else that we wanted to talk about?
Yeah, well, there is one thing I wanted to mention about the website, studiolighting.net. I wanted to give a quick shout-out to Chris Malineo, because for those of you that are following the news at the site, Chris is the main dude behind the news feed, and he's doing a great job. But I really wanted to mention the fact that he's been doing book reviews. So if you like to read photography books, Chris has taken a look at least three now, and we just started to feature them in the Studio Lighting books section on the site. So if you go to studiolighting.net, and in the left navigation bar, you click on Studio Photography Books, you will see Chris's book reviews. So check those out.
It's like Oprah's book club.
It is, like the book of the month club. Yeah.
Well, actually, we do have another email. You said we should talk about this on the show, especially once I figure out what I'm doing with my studio. John writes, I take photos in my garage. I want to create a continuous background. Yeah, no background, no back wall, floor join. Is there a best way angle to create the floor wall curve? I suspect that too tight of a curve, it would catch the light and create a linear hot spot, and too large of a curve would use up too much floor space. So he asks if we could answer this for him or suggest some how-to websites. That would be appreciated. And just a little something, those little curved walls or permanent curves, it's kind of like a permanent seamless background paper, they're actually called CYC, C-Y-C. It's short for cycloramas.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a mouthful there.
Did you spend some time on Wikipedia tonight or something?
It, well, you That's know, I awesome. Get my sources where I can. A cyclorama. It's a seamless curve. Essentially, it looks like a painted skateboard ramp, and they come in different sizes. You can probably build one in your garage, no problem. I would love to put one in the studio, so you know, get your hammer and nails out, Bill.
All right.
And I've also seen them in professional studios that I've been in where they'll have either a 24-foot wide one, or I've even seen some that are two-wall ones where they actually have a corner, and then they have a seamless curve at the base of them transitioning from floor into the wall and where the walls meet as well. So that way you kind of have like this bowl-type shape.
That'd be pretty cool.
That would be really cool. They're wonderful to have. And they're easy to take care of, too. When you want a new color, you just throw down some paint and use a long paint roller, and boom, you got a new color and ready for the next day of shooting. And kind of quick, funny aside story, the studio that I used to use in York when we would hire commercial shooters at the ad agency I worked for, they had to strip all of the paint off of their cyclorama after a while because the the paint got so thick from them applying all of the years of paint chips over, and this was like a son-owned business of his father used to own it sort of thing. So this was like, you know, two generations of people using this and repainting this sweep. Well, they had these paint chips that were probably about like 2 or 3 inches thick.
Oh, that's classic.
And they had to strip all of the paint off of it to start repainting it again. Because when they would put like a piece of furniture on this sweep wall, it would sink in.
Oh man, that's a lot of paint.
It's a lot of paint, and of course, it had no structural integrity to it. So
that's awesome.
So yeah, I guess there could be some maintenance involved with these things over time. There are a couple websites that I've found that I've looked at that make some prefab stuff. There's a company called ProCyc, ProCyc.com, and they offer different preformatted systems that give you the curved pieces that you can either snap into the rest of, you put them in place and then drywall the rest of it and things like that. And they have some installation videos on the website. I have no idea what pricing is, and I probably don't want to know.
Right.
But, I mean, I would assume that you could find some details. There's an education website that, you know, we'll see if we can link to from studiolighting.net that shows some how-to instructions if you want to start bending some plywood or fabric or linoleum or things like that to try and do it yourself.
Definitely.
Seems like the sizes of them are going to range anywhere between like an 18-inch radius, 12-inch radius, and sometimes they can even go up to like a 3-foot radius. So, yeah, I guess the curve really is only an indication of what space you would have available to you, I would think, in a garage or a base, and probably would factor in what you're shooting as well.
Yeah, because, you know, depending on how close you're going to be getting, or the distance between your subject and the wall and all that, and, you know, how far you need to light, you're going to need more light to light a larger sweep evenly, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
So in your garage, you know, you want to be a little bit careful with that.
Yeah, and even in a garage, you're probably going to be running into issues with depending on what kind of garage you have. You might be running into issues with ceiling height. So you're probably, we wouldn't be doing full body portraits or something like that.
Right.
So, I mean, there's tons and tons of different options out there, and it's just a matter of figuring out which one works best for what application you're looking for.
Right. And no matter what, if any of you guys do this project, post your pictures up in the Flickr group, because I'm sure there's a lot of listeners that are thinking like, what does this look like? Or what would that be? What would that involve? So definitely share with the community, man. That would be a lot of fun.
That would be a lot of fun. Maybe we can influence some people to start building one besides myself.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have a trip that's coming up as this show goes out. I'll be in Austin.
Yeah, man. Well, I wanted to mention that Austin trip. You're going to be hanging out with the iStockers.
Yes, it's a iStock Photo iStockalypse. It's going to be going on in Austin. When you get this, it's too late to sign up, so can't even bother with it.
It could be weird because you might be talking to people that are listening like while you're there.
Ooh, that would be freaky.
That would be. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just had a whole like, it's like on Heroes when Hero ran into Future Hero.
Yeah, exactly. Because we're doing this a couple days before you go, but the show will air while you're there.
Correct. So. Yes. Yeah, Bill's catching me before I jump on the plane and ditch down.
Yep.
So, yeah, it should be fun. It'll be 3 or 4 days of shooting, various locations. So lots of fun people to hang out with that I haven't seen in a while and some that I haven't met yet. So it'll be pretty cool.
Outstanding. Well, have a good time, man.
I'll do my best.
Bring us back some cool images to talk about.
I thought you were going to say steer heads or something.
Well, yeah, bring me back a steer.
I'll bring you back horns awesome. For the front of your Cadillac.
That would be beautiful. If you bring me back horns, I will put them on my car.
Somehow I don't see that on the Infiniti.
No, I don't have an Infiniti, so you don't have to worry about that.
What do you? Oh, you have the Lexus. That's right.
No. Yeah, I have the Escalade. Oh. No, I don't have an Escalade.
Schwinn.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'll put it on my pedal bike.
Horns on my Schwinn.
Yep. My Razor scooter. Well, we should probably let these poor people hear the interview.
Yeah, we should. We have been babbling about, but it does sound like we've been having fun so far.
I think so.
Well, on this episode with us this evening, we have David Bean, a commercial photographer, specializes in... I guess I should say edgy portraits. Really, it's a very good modern style. I love the use of light and especially your post-processing technique. Your clients are such as Paramount, ESPN, Fender, EMI Music. It seems like you have a lot of music guys in your portfolio there.
Yeah, that's because I live in Nashville.
Of course, that's where they all are.
Well, we make more music videos here than anywhere except LA. So
wow, that's awesome.
I guess I really didn't realize that it was not all just the country music capital, but it's really a big music town, huh?
It's the capital of country music and Christian music, as well as a lot of indie rock. And actually, there's probably like a recording studio in every single basement in the county that I live in.
Nice.
Rush records here, and a lot of the pop divas record here. So, because we have maybe next to LA, the best engineers and producers anywhere. So
that's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah. We've got some good photographers there too, and we're really pleased to be speaking with you tonight. Could you tell our audience a little bit about how you kind of got into photography? Have you been doing this for a while?
Yeah, I've been probably shooting professionally for about 8 years maybe, and it kind of started. I've owned a graphic design firm for like 10 years, and about 3 years ago I just quit doing graphic design altogether. I just got completely burnt out on it. But about 8 years ago, I was doing all these websites for record labels, and I don't know where this guy got the idea that I did photography, but about 8 years ago, one of my design clients was like, "You shoot bands, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And so
of course.
He like, needs you to shoot this band, and so I'll never say no to a challenge. So I went out and bought a camera, bought some slide film, because back then that was what you had to turn into record labels, was slide film. Everything was on slide. So did the shoot, came out pretty good, and I'm like, man, this is pretty cool. And so I just kept investing and shooting a little bit on the side and still doing my design. And then about, 3 years ago, I just was like, this is fun, but I can't do design and photography. So goodbye design, and just been doing photography full time since.
That's awesome. That's a great story. So who was the first band?
They were a band called Shaded Red. You probably never heard of them, but... And I mean, I looking back, I think, it came out pretty good. But 8 years ago, I mean, if you ask them, I don't know what they would say. But I used I went full on. I like rented hot lights and soft boxes, and I'd never used any of that stuff before. And it came out. I mean, I have the slides, and I think they look pretty good to this day. But
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Good for you, man.
Yeah, I'm of the school of, never turn down an opportunity.
No doubt. So would you say that most of your professional work is with musicians?
I would say probably like 60%. And then another, the other 40 is like maybe a commercial. I mean, you know, it's all commercial, but I mean like corporate and editorial kind of stuff. So businesses. Great.
So coming from the commercial background and getting into the photography aspect of it, did you go back for any schooling in terms of, you know, what to do with lighting or things like that with your equipment? Or is it pretty much learn as you go and, you know, just continually expand your knowledge?
I mean, I've got, like, you know, a dirty secret. Every time I meet with clients, even graphic designers, I barely graduated high school. I failed the 11th grade. The only schooling I've been to is a 9-month Bible college. I'm completely self-taught, not just in photography, but design and life and just everything.
That's awesome.
I mean, I've really, really worked hard to teach myself everything I know. And I wish I would have gone to school. I didn't get my act together until I was about 20. I just kind of wasted the first 20 years of my life. And so at the age of 20, I'm like, you know, I just got to get into this. And so I really, hours at Barnes & Noble, sitting on the floor, reading magazines and books, and going online and just reading, you know, sites like yours and other kind of stuff, those kind of things, and just taught myself everything I know and went out and just did it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, you could never tell that from your portfolio. You've got an awesome portfolio, man. But, you know, now that I think about it, maybe it explains some of the really unique framing and stuff that I see that I really like in your portfolio.
Well, it comes a lot from the graphic design background because, right. I mean, I really studied design pretty hardcore on my own, and I really feel like I know design really well. And so when I shoot, I really try to think from a designer's perspective, composition and empty space and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I never got into the rule of thirds for whatever reason, but you know, all the other design rules I kind of apply to photography. So,
and I think I definitely see that coming through in your work, especially like your website, in which is www.visualreserve.com for those mm-hmm. following along at home. Your website design really ties in well with a lot of the images that you've selected that go out there. It's definitely has your signature to it.
Yeah, I've tried to. I mean, nothing against like all the live book sites and all that kind of stuff. I just wanted something that when people went there, it did kind of brand a personality. It wasn't just kind of sterile, but I also didn't want it to get in the way of the photos. So it was really kind of hard to make something kind of simple, but still with some personality.
Right.
So, and it's got an amazing back end. I can update this thing from China like with the click of a button. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about some of the images in your portfolio. You've got a couple of sections with people, which I guess I'd like to maybe start with. One of the things that I noticed being really unique about your images was sort of some of the locations that you've chosen. Do you spend a lot of time like sort of hunting for locations? How do you get some of that grungy kind of stuff?
You know, it's funny you ask that because I'm in the process right now of writing an article. I'm going to try to submit it to a magazine or something, but I'm going to write an article about the art of location scouting.
Nice.
And yeah, that's kind of something that not a lot of photographers do, surprisingly, that I know. I mean, a lot of people are either tied to a studio or they just go wherever the client tells them, but I spend a lot of time scouting locations, and I bring my camera, you know, I bring like a cheaper camera with me wherever I go, and if I see a location, I take a picture of it, and I've got, you know, in iView Media, just a separate folder just for location scouting. And so
that's cool.
I'm always collecting locations and gathering locations and trying to, you know, either weasel my way into, you know, some place that, you know, a restaurant or a bar or for free, or trying to get in somewhere cheaper. You know, sometimes you got to pay $500, but, you know, whatever it takes to get in a cool place.
So what are some of the things that your article is going to talk about in terms of what to look for?
Well, it's going to talk about a lot about the legal stuff, like when you need a permit, when you don't. How to get a permit, those kind of things. But, you know, just wherever you are, whatever, if you're in a bar, you're in a restaurant, you're in an old theater, wherever you are, just look around and say, would this be a great place to shoot? And just, it helps to be a friendly person because, I mean, you know, you can get favor with a lot of people real easily just saying, you know, hey, you know, would you mind if I shot here next week? And a lot of people will say yes, and some people want money, but, you know, I'd say like, 6 times out of 10, you can get in places for free.
Nice.
Some people are probably very flattered, too, as, you know, kind of like, it's like, oh, they want to use mine.
Yeah. And a lot of times people, they don't appreciate what they have. Like, you're going to some, like, dirty, dungy warehouse that just looks, you know, disgusting, and you're like, ah, oh, this is gold. You know, and like, can I shoot here? And they're like, why do you want to shoot here? This place is disgusting. And you're like, I know, I love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's exactly like my studio I just rented.
Yeah.
there's some really dark stuff. And it's funny. It's like people that do a style like this, that I guess I call it more of like a modern or a current graphic design stylistic treatment. It seems like those types of visual people like that tend to gravitate towards that urban decay or grunge.
Yeah. For me, it's all about juxtaposition. Like, I don't really... I like to put beautiful things against grungy things, and I mean, I don't always do it. Sometimes it's dirt against dirt, but I like to kind of merge styles, you know, put like, you know, a beautiful woman in a dirty place, or, you know, a guy in a suit in a dirty place or whatever, and just, I don't know, just kind of so that you're not, it's not typical.
Yeah, it gives it some tension.
Yeah.
Which exactly. is really cool.
Tension is a good word.
Actually, since you brought that up, I'm wondering, I could use some advice right now because I'm trying to pitch some people on shooting in those grungy situations. And say you're doing a fashion shoot. How do you present that to the model and say, you know, I have a really cool idea. It's like, I want to put you in this really disgusting environment.
Well, what you just tell her is that, you know, you're going to look that much more beautiful because the surroundings are ugly.
That's
awesome. For real. I mean, if you put her, like, in a 5-star restaurant or something, you know, she's seriously going to be detracted a little bit from the beautiful surroundings, the chandeliers and whatever. But, you know, you put her in a disgusting warehouse, she's going to look like $1 million. It's just plain and simple. So,
and at that point, that's when they say that they're bringing three of their friends for backup, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, the thing is, like, I shoot, I don't know how to explain this, but I make sure that when I shoot, I'm not shooting for me, like, not for my ego or for like, oh, I want to try this. Like, my job is to make the person look good. And so, you know, if they don't want to be shot in a dirty warehouse, then I'm not going to do it. But the whole thing is, some people nowadays, I see, you know, whether it's post-work or just locations or whatever, it seems like a lot of people, well, not a lot, there's just a few that seem to be shooting for their own ego. Where I think as photographers, we kind of need to realize that we're not, it's not about us, it's about the subject. And so whatever flatters the subject, and if a dirty warehouse will flatter them, then that's it. But if it won't flatter them, it just makes them look that much more dirty, then we don't do it. You know, we should never do anything just because we think it's cool.
That's great advice. And it kind of leads me to another question I wanted to ask you. Whenever you, you know, first meet up with a client or you have a potential client in mind, how is it that you assess what it is they're trying to communicate? Do you spend a lot of time asking questions, or do you run your ideas by them? How does that process work for you?
You know, I end up art directing a lot of my own shoots because the art director will just, they won't have any ideas. You know, they'll just be like, I mean, seriously, like sometimes, you know, they'll hire you and they'll say, pick a location, pick a stylist, da-da-da, and you're like, well, what do you want? And they're like, oh, we trust you. You know, it's like,
nice.
So a lot of times you end up art directing just, and the art director is just there kind of looking on. And then sometimes you get art directors that are just overly involved and, you know, they want control of everything. And I kind of like a mix of both, but it just depends on the situation. Like, you walk into some places and they know exactly what they want. They know what she's going to wear. They know the location, da-da-da. And that's cool. And sometimes, you know, you just step onto the set and you're there. But for the most part, the way I don't know if it's for what reason, but I seem to have always found myself having to do a lot of the work myself as far as producing the shoots and getting the locations. I don't know if it's because budgets have gotten smaller.
Right.
But, and I like it though. I like having that control. So.
Sure. Well, maybe I can ask you a little more specifically about some of the musicians that you work with. Is there a way, like, let's say you have a band that you're shooting, is there a way you kind of connect with them and try to get a feel for their image before you set them up in a particular location or posing and that sort of thing?
You know, you really don't have a lot of time before you start shooting when you meet them. I mean, unless you know them,
mm-hmm.
A lot of times, you know, you'll first meet them on the set. And so you're worried about getting your lights set up and your assistants and all that. And so it's kind of hard to build that repertoire. You do what you can just to beforehand know what they're into and do a little bit of research. And I had to buy a XM radio just because I was burning CDs and making iPod mixes. And it was so time consuming. And you never knew what the person was going to want to listen to. You know, so now with XM radio, whatever they're in the mood for, you just give them the radio. They can put whatever they want on. It helps them to, like, get in their own little zone. Like, if they're, like, I shot this one girl. She was trying out for some pop superstar group or whatever, and she got to the set, and, like, I never in a million years would have pegged her for a country music fan. So I would have brought, like, Madonna and all this other stuff. And so because of the satellite radio, you know, she just, her and her boyfriend just threw on this country stations and put her at ease. And So then I kind of knew, okay, she's a country girl, you know, and you just kind of just follow their lead and see what they're into.
That's a pretty cool idea. Yeah. So you usually have music on playing during the session then?
Yeah, I always do, unless it's like some kind of really like overly anal corporate thing. But
nice.
Yeah, even outside, I you know, got this amazing boombox for $99 that sounds amazing outside, and you can plug an iPod into it. So.
Well, that's pretty cool. I noticed that actually in your advertising section, there's a series that I really love. It's a set of seniors with iPods.
Oh, yeah, I love those, yeah.
It makes for a great, great series because it's totally not what you would expect them to be
yeah.
using.
Yeah. Yeah, they were actually I've had people say, what are they listening to? And they're actually listening to a pop punk band called Reliant K.
I've heard of them.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So it was actually one of my best friends does video. So we kind of, it's a really good relationship we have. And so he was shooting a video commercial for them at an old folks home. It was his idea, you know, to have these old folks listen to their music, and like he wanted them to say how much they hated it, and like, oh, this is terrible, and I would never listen to this. And ironically, some of them really liked it.
That's awesome.
But so I was along just kind of helping out, and I was like, man, this would make the most amazing stock photography.
Yeah.
So I just took a bunch of stuff. I'm fine with the stock agency, but I haven't even showed this to him yet. So.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about series, can I ask why beards?
Yeah, man, I gotta send you to the site. There's a site called Whiskerino.com. Actually, no, it's Whiskerino.com, or is it? Well, I'll find it and I'll tell you. But every 2 years in Nashville, there's a 4-month beard contest that I partake in.
That's awesome.
And we have people from like Scotland and Germany and all around the world. It's Whiskerino2005.com. And basically, you don't shave for 4 months. You start out clean shaven. And every day, you take a picture of yourself. And so at the end, we had this big beard throwdown. And so people flew in from Scotland and Germany and California,
oh,
all
man.
To Nashville. And we just had this like weekend beard throwdown. And and again, man, those beard shots, my stock rep, I still haven't got the model releases yet. But he's like killing me to get these model releases because he thinks they'll sell really well. So
that's great.
Yeah,
there are some pretty cool images in there.
Yeah, I'm looking down to the menu. I'm like, oh, music, celebrity, fashion, beards.
Right.
Yeah, and that seems to be a lot of people's favorites. In fact, I just got hired by the WWE, you know, the World Wrestling, whatever they're called.
Yeah,
they just hired me to shoot Hillbilly Jim. He was a big wrestler back in the day.
I remember him.
Yeah, he had the overalls and the beard.
Yeah.
So, yeah, actually, I just got a copy of the magazine. They got a nice little full page of him in there, but they wanted me to shoot him just like the beard photos. They loved the beard photos so much to, like, you want the exact same shot.
Oh,
so
that's
I had to go
awesome.
Out and buy, like, wood paneling from Home Depot and shoot him on it. So.
And he was a tall guy,
they wanted me to
too.
Rip myself off, basically, but it looked good.
Now, okay, let's talk a little bit about equipment.
Yeah.
First, I guess, let's just get the camera stuff out of the way. What do you typically shoot with?
I shoot with a 1DS Mark II.
Okay.
I have for a couple of years, and I just think it's the most amazing thing ever. I mean, it's not a Hasselblad, but honestly, I've got a friend of mine. He owns a 1DS Mark II also, and he also is forced to use a Hasselblad sometimes, and he hates the H2 or whatever it's called. He just can't stand it. He loves his 1DS Mark II so much better.
Wow.
I love it, and I also have a 20D that I use for a backup, and I'm telling you, man, that 20D is one of the most amazing pieces of technology ever invented. Yeah, the 20D, like, will go down. It should be in a museum as one of the most amazing things ever created. So, if you look at the Nikki Taylor, like, under fashion, there's a shot with a 20D. So.
So you don't have real strong feelings about your equipment then?
I'm very brand loyal.
That's awesome.
I believe in spending the extra for stuff, so. I started out shooting, I don't know how many years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, I had White Lightnings, and they're a great company. I love them. The lights were great, but I just felt like I wanted something more, so now I use all Pro Photo stuff. And then I've also just recently bought a few Alien Bs, and they really play well with the Pro Photos.
Okay, cool. So, well, speaking of lighting equipment, let's talk about a typical shot for you. What would you throw in the back of the truck, so to speak?
Oh, man, I've got a Mitsubishi Montero Sport, and that thing, you can't even, like, stick a piece of paper in there when it's all loaded up. I bring I overkill it. I bring 6 heads, including a ring light. They got 2 Profoto heads, 3 LEMBs, and then a Profoto ring light. And I'm going to buy 2 more of those Profoto compact monolights, Profoto monolights. So I'll have 8 total. And then I've got a battery inverter. I've got my stands. I've got a Pelican case. And I just foam core. Foam core is the most amazing thing. I made a homemade California Sunbounce. You ever seen those?
Oh, yeah. Those are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I made a homemade one that I just used on a shoot for Griffin Technology, and it worked really, really well. I'm not hardcore into, like, homemade stuff, but I've been kind of having fun with some of that kind of stuff lately, so.
Nothing wrong with that.
The only thing with the homemade California Sunbounce was I was shooting, and my assistant was trying to hold this thing that I made out of PVC, you know, and fabric, and it was like a sail, and he just could not hold on to it. And so, like, I guess there is value in spending the $600 on a California Sunbounce.
So now, is it kind of like the fabric material type thing, or are we talking more of a...
Yeah, it's not made to block the sun, it's just made to kind of shade it.
To flag it, okay.
And it reduces about, like, maybe you lose about a third of a stop, maybe. With the material that I bought.
Okay.
But it definitely needs to be a version 2 made, because version 1 wasn't very good. It did the job, but like my assistant almost flew over a bridge. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
That can be some of the issues with DIY stuff.
You know we're going to need pictures of this thing now.
Yeah. I mean, it's not anything attractive, but before every single shoot, I'm at Home Depot and Lowe's just looking at what I can... Not really build for, like, that kind of stuff, but for sets and stuff. I build a lot of sets and things, and so, like, I'm really into building, like, DIY sets, but not as much equipment.
Now, how elaborate do you get with the sets that you do? I mean, do you build a new room, or, because that's something I've been looking at doing more of myself.
You know that shot on the front page of my site with the guy in the water?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah. That amazing shot.
Went to Lowe's and just bought the cheapest bath that I could find and plugged it up with Gorilla Glue and put a liner in it and just stuff like that. I've built, like, walls of metal, and I never built, like, a room or anything, but I've got a studio, and so I've got the luxury of spending a whole day if I want just building something.
That's one thing I've been thinking about as well for my studio, is trying to come up with a way to do, like, a series of, like, fly-out walls that I can either do, like, different backgrounds, not necessarily roll-out backgrounds, but maybe, like, wallpaper-type stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot you can do with that. You know, I go to fabric stores and wallpaper stores all the time, and I don't know, some of that stuff works and some doesn't. It's trial and error.
I like the one that you have with the guy sitting in all of the light bulbs.
That's kind of an older one.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Jason Ealing. He was like a reality TV guy. He was on The Bachelorette years ago. I don't know what the idea behind that was. For some reason, when I saw this guy and heard about him, I just had an idea for, like, broken light bulbs and just to represent, just, I can't really explain, have the time to explain who he is or what he's about, but just the brokenness and the, I don't know, I try to be conceptual when I can. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes I don't. But if I have the time and the money and the whatever, I'll try to push a concept as far as I can. But
that's pretty cool.
Now, I'm picturing, you said you had the Montero Sport and you have it fully loaded that you can't put a piece of paper in, and you get to a location shoot and you're shooting outside. What's probably going to be the first things that you grab and start working with?
Well, I live and die by my Gary Fong light sphere.
Nice.
I totally shoot my profiles outside, but I'm really not into, I mean, this is like a trend now where, like, you see a lot of artificial-looking outdoor light shots.
Right.
I'm really not into shots where you look at a photo and you automatically think of the photographer or the lighting, and you're like, wow, that must have been some cool lighting, or who's that photographer? Like I said, it's all about the subject, especially outdoors. I mean, indoors maybe it's a little different, but outdoors I'm trying to find more of a natural light, so I try not to break out the strobes when I don't have to. I mean, I do it. Sometimes you need to. It's overcast, or you got a group of 5 guys or whatever. But me and my Newton bracket is the greatest bracket in the whole world. I swear by that, and my Gary Fong light sphere too. For if it's just one person outside, that's pretty much all. Maybe one other flash off to the side, but if I can get away without using strobes outside, I will. Just because I like that natural look. I just, when someone's outside, I don't want it to look like there's a strobe on them. So
right. Do you generally look at certain times of day or whatever when you're scheduling these outdoor shoots?
Yeah, but that never pans out. I mean, you know, the weather. I mean, you know, people talk about the coolness of the morning and the warm tones of the afternoon. And, you know, you don't have half the time, you don't really have the luxury to sit around and wait for the sky to turn warm, you know. So hence the reason for building my own sunbounce. So.
Actually, before we get too far away from it, I had to go out real quick to Newton website to check out the camera bracket.
Yeah.
And do you use that in conjunction with the Gary Fong light sphere?
Yeah, because I personally, I'm nothing against Gary. I'm sure he's a nice guy. But the thing doesn't work. I don't think the thing works at all when you turn it vertically. No matter what, I don't care what he says. The thing, it casts shadows like that I don't like when you just turn the camera and, you know, flip it. So I use the bracket. Like, I just use the bracket, and the light sphere is always sticking straight up above the lens.
So you're actually pointing, like, the circle part of it facing at the subject.
No, I stick it straight up. I always, whenever I shoot flash, the flash is always straight up or slightly angled. The light sphere, just it's almost like, you know, like a little mini softbox. It just really throws the light really well. So, but it's always straight up in the air, right over the axis of the lens.
Okay, I'm following you now.
Yeah, the Newton bracket, like all other brackets, you hold the bracket, you don't hold the camera. And to me, that's not very safe or stable or just not a good idea. So with the Newton, you hold the camera, you never hold the bracket. So it's a lot sturdier.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, I just love the thing.
Okay, so like when you're out in some of these locations and you're taking your lighting gear, you know, what do you do when there's no access to power?
I have bought the most amazing thing. It's made in Singapore, of all places, and it's called the Tronix Explorer. I don't know, you'll have to Google it, but there's a really good review. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Rob Galbraith, is that his name? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Galbraith.
Yeah,
Galbraith. Yeah, robgalbraith.com. He's got a review on it, and he gives it like a glowing review. And so after reading his review, I went out and bought one, and it's $250. Amazing customer service, even though they're in the Philippines and they're half a world away. The thing is like a champ. It's like the White Lightning Vagabond, but I would compare it more to the Dynalite. I think it's the Dynalite 1200, I don't know what it's called, but the Dynalite version of it is like $1,200. And this is $250, and it's every bit as good. And
wow.
It basically gives you probably like 200 pops of a strobe.
Jeez. That's
yeah,
great.
And the recycle time's pretty good.
And this is a $250 power inverter, basically.
Yeah, it's got a sine wave inverter. I know people that actually use Honda generators, and I'm very picky about my equipment. Like, it's all pretty much still in good shape. And the thing about generators is they'll slowly ruin your equipment over time, unless it's got a sine wave inverter in it. There is one Honda generator that I've been looking at that's $2,000 that's got a sine wave inverter. But if you don't have that, if you're just running off like a regular generator or some other portable power supply and it doesn't have that inverter, you're sending like little spikes to your equipment and it's going to slowly damage them. So this thing, you know, and the Vagabond and the Dynalite, they all have the sine wave inverter.
Oh, nice.
That's very cool. When you take your subjects indoors, could you describe like a typical beginning lighting setup for you? Like, what would be the first couple of lights that you set up inside?
It's just one person. I just love a softbox and a beauty dish, and that's all. I love the combination of a softbox and a beauty dish together. That's, to me, it's like, that's just the perfect light for one person. And then if you got, you know, a band of like four people, then I start breaking out the grids and gridding people. And okay. I got my, you know, my 5 foot pro photo reflector. That 5 foot reflector, man, that thing is just, I've never compared it to like a Broncolor parabolic reflector. And maybe it's not quite as good, I don't know. But that pro photo thing is like probably the most versatile thing I own. You could light five people or you could light one people with it.
And it's a collapsible, I mean, it closes down like the other
one. Yeah, it's just like the Broncolor. I mean, like I said, I don't know exactly the difference. I know the Broncolor is like twice as expensive, so I don't know. But, I mean, it's just an amazing thing.
Okay, so let's go back to the combination of a softbox and a beauty dish. For some of the people in the audience, like, where would you place these lights? Why is it so appealing to you?
Because I like the beauty dish on the person's face, and I like the softbox, you know, like kind of like at a 45-degree angle behind them. I don't know, for whatever reason, the beauty dish is, I know it's, you know, it's kind of a hard light. It doesn't work for everybody. You know, like I said, it may not work for every single person, but for most people, I don't know, I can either back it up or I can just kind of soften it, but that is just my favorite light for the front. And then the softbox in the back, I just think just gives it a nice other dimension to it, so it's not so flat.
So you're actually putting that around the back of the subject.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I mean, you gotta be careful of flare. You got a flag, you know, a lot of stuff I do requires a lot of flags because you got light kind of pointing at the lens sometimes, but don't always do that exact setup, but that's just kind of my favorite is those two.
Great.
And then the ring light, got the Profoto ring light, and I've gotten kind of interesting things. I'm starting to use it all over the place as a fill light, kind of like as a hair light and kind of like as a thing to, I don't know, fill in. It's just, I'm kind of experimenting now with just putting that ring light everywhere. I really haven't shot through it in like a year, so.
So you're just putting it on a stand and just trying different things.
Yeah, it's a great light. And these LEDs, man, those things, I bought them for gridding purposes. And, you know, the color temperature is like 5600 and the pro photos are 5200. So they're close enough that you don't have to worry about any inconsistencies. And they just do a great job of, like, if you need, like, a light in a small place, or if you just want to, you know, grid somebody I just love them.
Let's go back to your typical group setup then. When you talk about gridding the way that you did, would you then, like if you had five guys, are you talking about getting individual lights on each person, or what do you shoot to try to do?
I mean, it depends on the light you have, the available light, and what kind of look you're going for. But, you know, I like to, if I can, grid each person's face a little bit and get, like, maybe the 5-foot reflector kind of just as, like, the not the backup. I mean, it's the key light, really. But, I mean, that's your safety net, more or less, because that can get everyone. And so you don't have to worry about, that's, you know, that's it. But then gridding it just to make sure that the faces are perfect. And then you can dial down the 5-foot reflector, knowing that you've got the grids in their faces. You don't have to worry so much about, because, you know, if you've got their faces perfect, you don't have to worry too much about everything else.
Shadows on their bodies and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that can be artsy, and I don't know.
That's cool.
I mean, I'm all about experimentation, and I don't really do the same thing twice much, so.
That's an interesting thought. I mean, I guess I never really thought about that with a big group. I've always had trouble with lighting a big group, and I've always tried to compress the people as much as possible to get away from using all those different lights. But I guess I should probably think about that a little bit more. Maybe put more lights in my scene and grid them so that way you can focus on each individual.
Because, I mean, you could just put a five, like that the Photoflex thing you guys have. Mm-hmm. You could just use that, or, you know, the MyProPhoto 5-foot one, but the light's going to be very flat. It's not going to be very interesting. I mean, it'll look good, but it'll look safe. So with the grids, you can get a little more artsy, and you can play with, like, if you've got a softbox or whatever else you've got lighting on the rest of the people, you can get away with crazy stuff because you know the faces are going to look good. And that's just it's just something that I came up with in my brain. So,
Do you ever use reflectors?
Yeah, outside a lot. I mean, just like to bounce the sun?
Yeah, just
for bounce lights.
For like film, yeah.
I don't do it so much indoors. I do it a lot outdoors. Like for Hillbilly Gym, I think I just use one light. I use this big light bank that I have in my studio, and I shot it at him like from the side and then just bounced the other side with foam core, and it worked pretty good. It was like a nice, sort of a traditional-looking, well, it wasn't traditional-looking, but the lighting was good.
Now, one of the things about your style, I think, that's probably a good signature, and it probably comes from the graphic design background, is your post-processing work.
Yeah.
It's not cross-processed. I'm looking at some of the images right now. One kind of has a cross-processed look, but it looks contrasty, saturated, and a bit sharp. What sorts of things do you go through when you're doing post-processing?
Everything's in Lightroom. I've been using Lightroom since the very, very first beta, and I've loved it. I'm a huge Adobe fan, everything they do. It's just a little slow. I mean, I went through, you know, trying to find my style, like early on. I went through the whole, let's desaturate everything, you know, make everything dark, and just trying all this stuff. And then I just came to the realization that, you know what, I really like color. I love color. And so, you know, I punch or pull back a few colors, but for the most part, I don't want to lose that color anymore. So I'm really big into color, and I may change even some colors around, but I do it all in Lightroom. Basically, when I shoot, I basically import, just tell you my workflow, I import everything into iView Media, and then in iView, I go through and delete all the garbage. So all the ones that are saved are all the keepers. Then I take those keepers and import them into Lightroom because I don't want to have to delete stuff in Lightroom. It takes forever. So then I got all my good ones in Lightroom. Then I go through and I do a lot of batch processing, simple, you know, copy and paste settings, and then I'll upload, you know, a web gallery for the client, and then I'll do like a page of like, you know, 5 or 6. I'll take them into Photoshop and do like extreme, you know, touch-ups on them, and so I can show them the full potential of what the images could look like. So,
do you take your computers on your shoots with you all the time?
I pretty much just take PowerBook. There'll be times when I'll have to lug a G5 or something, but when you travel and you rent, you know, they give you the G5 and the monitor and all that. But if I'm just around town or in my studio, I mean, it'll just be the PowerBook. I'm actually switching studios to a newer, better one, so it'll be really nice.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's exciting.
So now when you're using the notebook on location, and I know you said you organize and collect in iView, do you shoot direct to the hard drive, or do you just...
I try to shoot tethered into Lightroom most of the time, but sometimes it's just a real pain. I just still have not invested in... There's a clip. I think you guys might have talked about it once that holds your tether cable to your camera.
Yeah. That is
yes.
Cool.
I heard it from you guys, and I gotta buy that because I love shooting tethered. I love shooting directly into Lightroom, but that cable, that FireWire cable into my camera, if it even comes barely loose, you gotta like reset everything. So
that's a pain.
But if not, I own. You might laugh, but I own a total of 4 compact flash cards. That's all I own. That's all I ever need. So I basically, if I'm not shooting tethered, I just shoot, and the card's full, give it to my assistant, he downloads it, take another one out, shoot that. Yeah, just, you know, rotate. And then I've also got the Epson T2000. So, like, when I shoot the X Games or any kind of sports, like I'm shooting basketball this weekend, you know, the Epson T2000 is like a lifesaver. You just, you can put it on your belt. It's got a little belt loop thing, and you just keep swapping cards in and out of that thing.
Nice.
So you dump to the P2000. For the people that are listening, it's a digital photo wallet. It has a CF card reader, and it copies things down to a hard drive. Do you feel safe knowing that that is your only copy of the images since you're going to be reshooting on that CF?
No. I never feel safe. I'm probably, I don't know, I'm lucky. I hear all these people talk about, you know, before I leave the set, I've got three copies of everything. And I don't do that, and I probably should, and I really need to figure something out. Because I like to erase my cards as soon as I dump them. That way, when I put them back in the CF wallet and I put it back in my camera, if there's something, if I put it in my camera, if there's something on the card, that means it hasn't been dumped. So I erase it to know that that card's the next card to use.
Right, I see what you're saying. Usually yeah. What I'll do is, in my little card wallet that I have, if I know that I need to dump it, I have the back of it facing out.
Exactly, that's what I do, yeah.
If I know that it's ready to use, I have the face of it pointing out.
Well, yeah. let's just touch on a couple of the other types of shooting you do, even though it's not really much for lighting, I guess. Well, maybe it is. Tell us about what it's like to be at the X Games.
It's fun, and it's a lot of work. I mean, as far as lighting go, I remember the first year I was there seeing, because I had never really shot action sports a lot before then, and I never knew that people brought, like, softboxes and stuff to the X Games. Like, a lot of people had, like, their flashes on stands and, like, little mini softboxes triggered wirelessly. Like, they'll be, you know, like, they'll be, like, a half pipe, and they'll have, like, a flash, you know, up there on the top of the ramp, and they'll wow. be, like, you know, 10 feet away. And so I was like, oh, that's how you do this kind of stuff. But I, you know, for the most part, just bought my Gary Fong and my 580, and one of the best things I own is that Quantum Turbo 2x2 battery pack. That's what I take the X Games. I mean, and anywhere I shoot with the flash, because I, no offense to anybody that shoots with batteries, but you just can't shoot with AA's, in my opinion. It just doesn't work. Like, you shoot
<tried
one
it.
laughs> shot, and then you got to wait a couple seconds.
Right.
And then, like, you know, after, like, half an hour, your battery's so drained, you're just missing shot after shot. You miss the timing because you're waiting on batteries.
Okay, so it's like a belt pack that has batteries in it for powering your portable strobe.
It's basically just a giant battery that right. sits on your belt. Yeah, and it gives you, I mean, listen to this, it gives you 800 to 1,000 full power flashes with a 1 second recycle time.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's $500, which is a, you know, a lot of money, but think of how many, you know, you got to buy batteries, and batteries are so expensive.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So you kind of make up the money in like a year. It's the thing about shooting action sports is it really makes you a really good photographer, because there's nothing else in photography where you have to think so fast, and you only have like a splittest of a second to get the shot, and then if you don't get in that one split second, it's over. And so it really trains you to become, to think fast on your feet and to make good decisions and let the people timing, because timing, like, I mean, just talk about timing for a minute. Like, the stuff that you learn shooting sports, like when you're shooting models, I learned this when I've shot Nikki Taylor twice, and I went to Thailand with her also, but when the times that I've shot her just in a studio, you know, she's like one of the top models of all time, and she, you know, you don't have to tell her what to do. She just turns it on, and you just got to keep up with her. But I learned, the first time I shot her, I learned that timing is everything with a model. You got to learn, like, their rhythm and their timing, and as soon as you click that shutter, she would just automatically, boop, she's on her next pose. Like, you don't get a second wow. shot with a pose. You can't say, oh, do that again. She's just, you shoot, there's something else. And so I learned, okay, this is her rhythm, this is her timing. And ever since I shot her, I've tried to learn with other people that you got to learn a person's timing. And as soon as you click that shutter, you've got to figure out when to click it again, you know?
Right.
And if you click it too soon, you're going to miss them. Click it too late, you're going to miss them. But there's like a timing and a rhythm to everybody you shoot. And you just kind of learn as you shoot them. I don't know how to explain it, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
when they're on and when they're not on.
I know exactly what you're saying. I was down at the studio the other day with my kids, and it was one of the few times that I actually became very, very conscious of that.
Yeah.
And just the way that, you know, trying to get them into a rhythm and
mm-hmm.
realizing that, yeah, there really is a magic 500th of a second.
Right. So being at the X Games and taking some of that back to the studio with you has actually been a cool experience then, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's just fun.
Now, you also have some stuff in your portfolio from concerts, and that's a really tricky sort of environment, especially for lighting. What kind of an approach do you usually take when you're at a concert?
Man, it depends wildly, because like a lot of times, like even like you're getting paid to shoot. Well, I mean, you're always getting paid, but I mean, it depends on who you're getting paid by. Like I shot the Warped Tour. You know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
I shot that for Singular, and even then, you only get to shoot for the first three songs, and then the security's like, you're out of here. So you've only got three songs of any band's acts to shoot.
Wow.
So you've got to have two cameras on you. That's when I break out the 20D. I've got the 1DS Mark II with the 24 to 70, and then I've got the 20D with the 70 to 200, which actually turns into like a 105 to a 350 or whatever on the 20D. And so you've got to just straddle back and forth between the two cameras, because you can't get all wide, you can't get all zoom. So you're sweating, your neck is breaking, you got two cameras around your neck. But it's fun, and you get to see a good show. So
when you're in a concert environment, do you rely on, I guess, stage lighting most of the time if it's like an indoor concert?
Yeah, I just shot something. I just shot some bands for these bands that were playing for labels here in town. We had like a festival where bands showcased for labels, and I got hired to shoot like six or seven of the bands. And I brought the same two lenses, a 24 to 70 and a 70 to 200, and they're both 2.8 all the way. And I hate to use flash in a concert because I think it's kind of annoying, but I had to because I'm like, I'm getting paid for this. All they care about is the end result. They're not going to care if I annoy some fan behind me. So I popped off a few more flashes than I would have liked, but some of the best shots I've done were with the 50 1.4.
Nice.
I think it's the, let me see. Yeah, that very first shot on the concerts page, those two were with the 50 1.4, probably at 1.4, I'm sure, without any external light. So
that's great.
Oh, wow.
That's an amazing lens,
Yeah, those are really fun to have around.
And that was actually shot with a 20D, so that, the 50 and a 20D becomes like a 75 or something. So
right. Speaking of lenses, might as well just ask you, too, do you have like a favorite portrait lens when you're not at a concert, just in general?
Yeah, the 70 to 200 is my favorite by far for portraits. I shoot almost all portraits at 200 millimeters.
Really?
Yeah, I don't hardly ever shoot anything. I mean, it depends what a portrait is. If it's an environmental portrait, then I'll put the 24 on and shoot it at 24.
Right.
But I mean, if it's kind of like a more of a headshot-y kind of portrait, then I'll just go 200 just to get that background, just completely the bokeh and the blown out and everything. So.
Well, you've got some really amazing images. Let me ask you this question right before we wrap up here.
Yeah.
If you had some advice, I know you mentioned before we started recording that you really enjoy spending a lot of time with your assistants and getting people up to speed, sharing your knowledge. What would be some advice that you would give to somebody who's just starting out once they kind of get into this type of work?
Shoot everything and anything you can. Shoot a lot of stuff for free. But at the same time, like the problem with people who are getting into photography now is, the rates are kind of being driven down because a lot of people don't understand like what to charge. And so when I say shoot everything, for free, I'd rather someone shoot something for free than someone shoot something for $100, because
right.
Shoot something for free, there's not like a value attached to it. But you shoot something for $100 and then that means that's worth $100. So I would just encourage people to shoot your friends. If you have friends in a band, shoot them. Just shoot anything and everything you can and be confident that, you're worth some money. What you're doing is valuable, and don't sell yourself short. I would recommend assisting. I never assisted, and I kind of regret that. Like I said, all my assistants, there's like a lot of good assistants in Nashville, and I don't use any of them. I just take people that I know and like and train them, because I'd rather have a friendly face on a set than some know-it-all. So I don't, and just find a photographer that has a small enough ego that they don't mind imparting knowledge to you. Like, that's where assisting comes in. If you can assist for someone that doesn't feel threatened by somebody else, then you can learn a lot.
Right.
So I've actually, on Flickr, I started a group called Assistance Wanted, and it's got like 100 or some members, but it's a place, my intention was to match up people who wanted to assist with photographers. And I've actually found my favorite assistant on there. A guy that I use named Ben, I found him on that group, and he's my favorite by far now.
That's cool.
I also have a group on Flickr that I started called Pro Corner. We've got like 3,000 members now. It's a group for professional photographers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've been to that one. I like that one a lot.
Yeah. So.
Can Bill and I join it since we're only semi-pro?
You know, I might actually make you guys moderators because I don't have the time to keep an eye on it. So. Yeah, I don't know. You probably don't either, but.
I think that's one thing that is really cool about you, and I've seen you contribute even in our Flickr group, and it is really something to get in touch with a photographer that's willing to sort of spread the knowledge. So it's really neat, too, that you've taught yourself, and now you're teaching everyone else. So thank you very much for spending some time with us tonight.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. I mean, what you guys do is good. So, I mean, I'm a huge believer in giving back any way I can. I think every photographer needs to do pro bono work and stuff like that. So,
well, cool. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, that's all we have for this episode of Light Source,
the brightest podcast on the internet.
Be sure to check out the show notes at studiolighting.net for the things that we talked about on today's show.
And there you can also find links about our photography and keep up with the stuff that we've been shooting.
And don't forget, you can send us feedback or questions about the show to studiolighting@gmail.com.
And we'll try to answer those questions on the show or in the lighting questions section on studiolighting.net.
You can also get feedback on your photography in our Flickr group, which is at www.flickr.com/groups/lightsource. Till next time.
Take care.
Check out this show and more great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.